It was not at all strange in the life common to sailors that, having already crossed the Atlantic twice and being now halfway from Boston to the Horn, I should find myself still among friends. My determination to sail westward from Gibraltar not only enabled me to escape the pirates of the Red Sea, but in bringing me to Pernambuco, landed me on familiar shores. I'd made many voyages to this and other ports in Brazil. Fruits and vegetables and all other provisions necessary for the voyage having been taken in, on the 23rd of October I unmoored and made ready for sea. Making about 100 miles a day along the coast, I arrived at Rio de Janeiro, November 5th, without any event worth mentioning, and about noon cast anchor. The Spray, with a number of old shipmasters on board, sailed about the harbor of Rio the day before she put to sea. As I had decided to give the Spray a yawl rig for the tempestuous waters of Patagonia, I here placed on the stern a semicircular brace to support a jigger mast. These old captains inspected the Spray's rigging, and each one contributed something to her outfit. Captain Jones, who had acted as my interpreter at Rio, gave her an anchor, and one of the steamers gave her a cable to match it. On November 28th, the Spray sailed from Rio de Janeiro and first of all ran into a gale of wind, which tore up things generally along the coast, doing considerable damage to shipping. It was well for me, perhaps, that she was well clear of the land. Coasting along on this part of the voyage, I observed that while some of the small vessels I fell in with were able to outsail the Spray by day, they fell astern of her by night. To the Spray, day and night were the same. To the others, clearly, there was a difference. On one of the very fine days experienced after leaving Rio, the steamship South Wales spoke the Spray and, unsolicited, gave her the longitude by chronometer as 48 degrees west. "As near as I can make it," the captain said. The Spray, with her 10 clock, had exactly the same reckoning. I was feeling at ease in my primitive method of navigation, but it startled me not a little to find my position by account verified by the ship's chronometer. On December 5th, a barkentine hove in sight, and for several days the two vessels sailed along the coast together. Right here a current was experienced setting north, making it necessary to hug the shore, with which the Spray became rather familiar. Here I confess a weakness. I hugged the shore entirely too close. In a word, at daybreak on the morning of December 11th, the Spray ran hard and fast on the beach. This was annoying, but I soon found that the sloop was in no great danger. I managed to launch my small dory from the deck and ran out a kedge anchor and warp, but it was too late to kedge the sloop off, for the tide was falling. Then I went about laying out the larger anchor, which was no easy matter, for my only lifeboat, the frail dory, when the anchor and cable were in it, was swamped at once in the surf, the load being too great for her. Then I cut the cable and made two loads of it instead of one. The anchor, with 40 fathoms bent and already buoyed, I now took and succeeded in getting through the surf, but my dory was leaking fast, and by the time I had rowed far enough to drop the anchor, she was full to the gunwale and sinking. There was not a moment to spare, and I saw clearly that if I failed now, all might be lost. I sprang from the oars to my feet, and lifting the anchor above my head, threw it clear just as she was turning over. I grasped her gunwale and held on as she turned bottom up, for I suddenly realized I couldn't swim. Then I tried to right her, but with too much eagerness, for she rolled clean over and left me as before, clinging to her gunwale, while my body was still in the water. Giving a moment to cool reflection, I found that although the wind was blowing moderately toward the land, the current was carrying me to the sea, and that something would have to be done. Three times I had been underwater and trying to right the dory, and I was just saying, "Now I lay me," when I was seized by a determination to try yet once more, so that none of the prophets of evil I had left behind me could say, "I told you so." Whatever the danger may have been, much or little, I can truly say that the moment was the most serene of my life. After riding the dory for the fourth time, I finally succeeded by the utmost care in keeping her upright while I hauled myself into her and with one of the oars, which I had recovered, paddled to the shore, somewhat the worse for wear and pretty full of salt water. The position of my vessel, now high and dry, gave me anxiety. To get her afloat again was all that I thought of or cared for. I had little difficulty in carrying the second part of my cable out and securing it to the first, which I had taken the precaution to buoy before I put it into the boat. To bring the end back to the sloop was a smaller matter still, and I believe I chuckled above my sorrows when I found that in all the haphazard my judgment or my good genius had faithfully stood by me. The cable reached from the anchor in deep water to the sloop's windlass by just enough to secure a turn and no more. The anchor had been dropped at the right distance from the vessel. To heave all taut now and wait for the coming tide was all I could do. I had already done enough work to tire a stouter man. I was only too glad to throw myself on the sand above the tide and rest, for the sun was already up and pouring a generous warmth over the land. While my state could have been worse, I was on the wild coast of a foreign country and not entirely secure in my property, as I soon found out. I had not been long on the shore when I heard the patter-patter of a horse's feet approaching along the hard beach, which ceased as it came abreast of the sand ridge where I lay sheltered from the wind. Looking up cautiously, I saw mounted on a nag probably the most astonished boy on the whole coast. He found a sloop. "It must be mine," he thought, "for am I not the first to see it on the beach?" Sure enough, there it was, all high and dry and painted white. He trotted his horse around it, and finding no owner, hitched the nag to the sloop's bobstay and hauled as though he would take her home. But, of course, she was too heavy for one horse to move. With my skiff, however, it was different. This he hauled some distance and concealed behind a dune in a bunch of tall grass. He had made up his mind, I dare say, to bring more horses and drag his bigger prize away, and was starting off for reinforcements when I discovered myself to him, at which he seemed displeased and disappointed. "Buenos dias, muchacho," I said. He grunted a reply and eyed me keenly from head to foot. Then, bursting into a volley of questions, more than six Yankees could ask, he wanted to know, first, where my ship was from and how many days she'd been coming. Then he asked what I was doing here ashore so early in the morning. "Your questions are easily answered. My ship is from the moon. It has taken her a month to come, and she is here for a cargo of boys." But the intimation of this enterprise, had I not been on the alert, might have cost me dearly. For while I spoke, this child of the campo coiled his lariat ready to throw, and instead of being himself carried to the moon, he was apparently thinking of towing me home by the neck, astern of his wild cayuse over the fields of Uruguay. The exact spot where I was stranded was at the Castillo Chicos, about 7 miles south of the dividing line of Uruguay and Brazil, and of course the natives there speak Spanish. To reconcile my early visitor, I told him that I had on my ship biscuits, and that I wished to trade them for butter and milk. On hearing this, a broad grin lighted up his face and showed me that he was greatly interested, and that even in Uruguay a ship's biscuit will cheer the heart of a boy and make him your bosom friend. The lad almost flew home, and returned quickly with butter, milk, and eggs. A coast guard from Fort Teresa, a few miles away, also came to protect your property from the natives of the plains, he said. Early in the day, a dispatch came from the port captain of Montevideo, commanding the coast guards to render the spray every assistance. This, however, was not necessary, for a guard was already on the alert and making all the ado that would become the wreck of a steamer with 1,000 immigrants aboard. The same messenger brought word from the port captain that he would dispatch a steam tug to tow the spray to Montevideo. The officer was as good as his word. A powerful tug arrived on the following day, but to make a long story short, with the help of the German and one soldier and one Italian called Angel of Milan, I had already floated the sloop and was sailing for port with the boom off before a fair wind. The adventure cost the spray no small amount of pounding on the hard sand. She lost her shoe and part of her false keel, and received other damage, which, however, was readily mended afterward in dock. Shortly after, the spray sailed for Montevideo, where she arrived on the following day and was greeted by steam whistles till I felt embarrassed and wished that I had arrived unobserved. The voyage so far alone may have seemed to the Uruguayans a feat worthy of some recognition, but there was so much of it yet ahead, and of such an arduous nature, that any demonstration at this point seemed somehow like boasting prematurely. The spray had barely come to anchor at Montevideo when the agents of the Royal Mail Steamship Company, Humphreys and Company, sent word that they would dock and repair free of expense and give me £20 sterling, which they did to the letter and more besides. The caulkers at Montevideo paid very careful attention to the work of making the sloop tight. Carpenters mended the keel and also the lifeboat, painting it till I hardly knew it from a butterfly. Christmas of 1895 found the Spray refitted even to a wonderful makeshift stove, which was contrived from a large iron drum of some sort, punched full of holes to give it a draft. The pipe reached straight up through the top of the forecastle. Now, this was not a stove by mere courtesy. It was always hungry, even for green wood. And in cold, wet days off the coast of Tierra del Fuego, it stood me in good stead. Its one door swung on copper hinges, which one of the yard apprentices, with laudable pride, polished till the whole thing blushed like the brass binnacle of a P&O steamer. The Spray was now ready for sea. Instead of proceeding at once on her voyage, however, she made an excursion up the river, sailing December 29. An old friend of mine, Captain Howard of Cape Cod and of River Plate fame, took the trip in her to Buenos Aires, where she arrived early on the following day with a gale of wind and a current so much in her favor that she outdid herself. In all the years away from his native home, Howard had not forgotten the art of making fish chowders, and to prove this, he brought along some fine rockfish and prepared a mess fit for kings. When the savory chowder was done, chalking the pot securely between two boxes on the cabin floor so that it could not roll over, we helped ourselves and swapped yarns over it while the Spray made her own way through the darkness on the river. Howard told me stories about the Fuegian cannibals as she reeled along, and I told him about the pilot of the Pinta steering my vessel through the storm off the coast of the Azores, and that I looked for him at the helm in a gale such as this. I did not charge Howard with superstition. We are none of us superstitious. But when I spoke about his returning to Montevideo on the Spray, he shook his head and took a steam packet instead. I'd not been in Buenos Aires for a number of years. The place where I had landed from packets was now built up with magnificent docks. Vast fortunes had been spent remodeling the harbor. London bankers could tell you that. The port captain, after assigning the Spray in a safe berth with his compliments, sent me word to call on him for anything I might want while in port, and I felt quite sure that his friendship was sincere. The sloop was well cared for at Buenos Aires. Her dockage and tonnage dues were all free, and the yachting fraternity of the city welcomed her with a good will. In town I found things not so greatly changed as about the docks, and I soon felt myself more at home. The man who sold lemonade on the plaza when I first visited this wonderful city, I found selling lemonade still at 2 cents a glass. He'd made a fortune by it. His stock in trade was a washtub and a neighboring hydrant, a moderate supply of brown sugar, and about 6 lemons that floated on the sweetened water. The water from time to time was renewed from the friendly pump, but the lemon went on forever, and all at 2 cents a glass. But we looked in vain for the man who once sold whiskey in coffins in Buenos Aires. The march of civilization had crushed him. Memory only clung to his name. Enterprising man that he was, I fain would have looked him up. I remember the tiers of whiskey barrels ranged on end on one side of the store, while on the other side, and divided by a thin partition, were the coffins in the same order, of all sizes, and in great numbers. The unique arrangement seemed in order, for as a cask was emptied, a coffin might be filled. Besides cheap whiskey and many other liquors, he sold cider, which he manufactured from damaged Malaga raisins. Within the scope of his enterprise was also the sale of mineral waters, not entirely blameless of the germs of disease. This man surely catered to all the tastes, wants, and conditions of his customers. On January 26, 1896, the Spray, being refitted and well-provisioned in every way, sailed from Buenos Aires. There was little wind at the start. The surface of the great river was like a silver disk, and I was glad of a tow from the harbor tug to clear the port entrance. But a gale came up soon after and caused an ugly sea, and instead of being all silver as before, the river was now all mud. I cast anchor before dark in the best lee I could find near the land, but was tossed miserably all night, heartsore of choppy seas. On the following morning, I got the sloop underway, and with reef sails worked it down the river against a headwind. I had not for many years been south of these regions. I will not say that I expected all fine sailing on the course for Cape Horn direct, But while I worked at the sails and rigging, I thought only of onward and forward. It was when I anchored in the lonely places that a feeling of awe crept over me. At the last anchorage on the monotonous and muddy river, weak as it may seem, I gave way to my feelings. I resolved then that I would anchor no more north of the Strait of Magellan. On the 28th of January, the spray was clear of Point Indio and all the other dangers of the River Plate. With a fair wind, she then bore away for the Strait of Magellan, under all sail, pressing farther and farther toward the wonderland of the south, till I forgot the blessings of our milder north. My ship passed in safety Bahia Blanca, also the Gulf of St. Matthias and the mighty Gulf of St. George. Hoping that she might go clear of the destructive tide races, the dread of big craft or little along this coast, I gave all the capes a berth of about 50 miles, for these dangers extend many miles from the land. But where the sloop avoided one danger, she encountered another. For one day, well off the Patagonian coast, a tremendous wave, the culmination, it seemed, of many waves, rolled down upon her in a storm roaring as it came. I had only a moment to get all sail down and myself out of danger when I saw the mighty crest towering masthead high above me. The mountain of water submerged my vessel. It may have been a minute that from my hold in the rigging I could see no part of the spray's hull. Perhaps it was even less time than that, but it seemed a long while, for under great excitement one lives fast, and in a few seconds one may think a great deal of one's past life. Not only did the past with electric speed flash before me, but I had time while in my hazardous position for resolutions for the future that would take a long time to fulfill. On February 11th, the spray rounded Cape Virgins and entered the Strait of Magellan. The scene was again real and gloomy. The wind, northeast, and blowing a gale, sent feather-white spume along the coast. Such a sea ran as would swamp an ill-appointed ship. As the sloop neared the entrance to the strait, I observed that two great tide races made ahead, one very close to the point of the land and one farther offshore. Between the two, in a sort of channel through combers, went the spray with close-reefed sails. But a rolling sea followed her a long way in, and a fierce current swept around the cape against her. But this she stemmed, and was soon chirruping under the lee of Cape Virgins and running every minute into smoother water. However, long trailing kelp from sunken rocks waved forebodingly under her keel, and the wreck of a great steamship smashed on the beach abreast gave a gloomy aspect to the scene. I was not to be let off easy. The Virgins would collect tribute even from the spray passing their promontory. I reefed the sloop sails, and sitting in the cabin to rest my eyes, I was so strongly impressed with what in all nature I might expect that as I dozed, the very air I breathed seemed to warn me of danger. My senses heard, "Spray ahoy!" shouted in warning. I sprang to the deck, wondering who could be there that knew the spray so well as to call out her name passing in the dark, for it was now the blackest of nights all around, except away in the southwest, where the old familiar white arch, the terror of Cape Horn, rapidly pushed up by a southwest gale. I had only a moment to douse sail and lash all solid when it struck like a shot from a cannon, and for the first half hour it was something to be remembered by way of a gale. For 30 hours it kept on blowing hard. The sloop held on stoutly and was not blown out of the strait. After this gale followed only a smart breeze, and the spray, passing through the narrows without a mishap, cast anchor at Sandy Point on February 14, 1896. Sandy Point, or Punta Arenas, is a Chilean coaling station and boasts about 2,000 inhabitants of mixed nationality, but mostly Chileans. What with sheep farming, gold mining, and hunting, the settlers in this dreary land seem not the worst off in the world. But the natives, Patagonian and Fuegian, on the other hand, were as squalid as contact with unscrupulous traders could make them. A large percentage of the business there was traffic in fire water. If there was a law against selling the poisonous stuff to the natives, it was not enforced. Fine specimens of the Patagonian race, looking smart in the morning when they came into town, had repented before night of ever having seen a white man, so beastly drunk were they, to say nothing about the peltry of which they'd been robbed. Altogether, the place was quite newsy and supported two papers, dailies, I think. The port captain, a Chilean naval officer, advised me to ship hands to fight Indians in the strait farther west, and spoke of my stopping until a gunboat should be going through, which would give me a tow. After canvassing the place, however, I found only one man willing to embark, and he on condition that I should ship another Mon Anadug. But as no one else is willing to come along, and as I drew the line at dogs, I said no more about the matter, but simply loaded my guns. At this point in my dilemma, Captain Pedro Samblich, a good Austrian of large experience, coming along, gave me a bag of carpet tacks, worth more than all the fighting men and dogs of Tierra del Fuego. I protested that I had no use for carpet tacks on board. Samblich smiled at my want of experience and maintained stoutly that I would have use for them. "You must use them with discretion. That is to say, don't step on them yourself." With this remote hint about the use of the tacks, I got on all right, and saw the way to maintain clear decks at night without the care of watching. Samblich was greatly interested in my voyage, and after giving me the tacks, he put on board bags of biscuits and a large quantity of smoked venison. He declared that my bread, which was ordinary sea biscuits and easily broken, was not nutritious as his, which was so hard that I could break it only with a stout blow from a maul. Then he gave me, from his own sloop, a compass, which was certainly better than mine, and offered to unbend her mainsail for me if I would accept it. Last of all, this large-hearted man brought out a bottle of Fuegian gold dust from a place where it had been cached, and begged me to help myself from it, for use farther along on the voyage. But I felt sure of success without this draft on a friend, and I was right. Samblich's tacks, as it turned out, were of more value than gold. The port captain, finding out that I was resolved to go, even alone, since there was no help for it, set up no further objections, but advised me, in case the savages tried to surround me with their canoes, to shoot straight, and to begin to do it in time, but to avoid killing them if possible, which I hardly agreed to do. With these simple injunctions, the officer gave me my port clearance, free of charge, and I sailed the same day, February 19, 1896. It was not without thoughts of strange and stirring adventure beyond all I had yet encountered that I now sailed into the country and the very core of the savage Fuegians. A fair wind from Sandy Point brought me on the first day to St. Nicholas Bay, where, so I was told, I might expect to see savages. But seeing no signs of life, I came to anchor in 8 fathoms of water, where I lay all night under a high mountain. Here I had my first experience with the terrific squalls called Williwaws, which extended from this point on through the strait to the Pacific. They were compressed gales of wind that Boreas handed down over the hills in chunks. A full-blown Williwaw will throw a ship, even without sail on, over or beam ends. But like other gales, they cease now and then, if only for a short time. February 20th was my birthday, and I found myself alone, with hardly so much as a bird in sight, off Cape Froward, the southernmost point of the continent of America. By daylight in the morning, I was getting my ship underway for the bout ahead. The sloop held the wind fair while she ran 30 miles farther on her course, which brought her to Fortescue Bay, and at once among the native signal fires which blazed up now on all sides. By daylight the next morning, the spray was again underway, beating hard. But she came to in a cove in Charles Island, 2.5 miles along on her course. Here she remained undisturbed 2 days, with both anchors down and a bed of kelp. Indeed, she might have remained undisturbed indefinitely had not the wind moderated, for during these 2 days it blew so hard that no boat could venture out on the strait, and the natives being away to other hunting grounds, the island anchorage was safe. But at the end of the fierce windstorm, fair weather came. Then I got my anchors and again sailed out upon the strait. Canoes manned by savages from Fortescue now came in pursuit. The wind falling light, they gained on me rapidly till coming within hail, when they ceased paddling, and a bow-legged savage stood up and called to me, "Yammer schooner! Yammer schooner!" which is their begging term. I said, "No!" Now, I was not for letting on that I was alone, and so I stepped into the cabin, and passing through the hold, came out at the forescuttle, changing my clothes as I went along. That made 2 men. Then the piece of bowsprit, which I had sawed off at Buenos Aires, and which I still had on board, I arranged forward on the lookout, dressed as a seaman, attaching a line by which I could pull it into motion. That made 3 of us, and we didn't want the Yammer schooner. But for all that, the savages came on faster than before. I saw that besides four at the paddles in the canoe nearest to me, there were others in the bottom, and that they were shifting hands often. At 80 yards, I fired a shot across the bows of the nearest canoe, at which they all stopped, but only for a moment. Seeing that they persisted in coming nearer, I fired the second shot so close to the chap who wanted a Yammer schooner that he changed his mind quickly enough and bellowed with fear. I was thinking of the good port captain's advice when I pulled the trigger, and must have aimed pretty straight. However, a miss was as good as a mile for Mr. Black Pedro, as he it was, and no other, a leader in several bloody massacres. He made for the island now, and the others followed him. I knew by his Spanish lingo and by his full beard that he was the villain I have named, a renegade mongrel and the worst murderer in Tierra del Fuego. The authorities had been in search of him for 2 years. The Fuegians are not bearded. So much for the first day among the savages. I came to anchor at midnight in Three Island Cove, about 20 miles along from Fortescue Bay. I saw on the opposite side of the strait signal fires and heard the barking of dogs, but where I lay it was quite deserted by natives. I've always taken it as a sign that where I found birds sitting about or seals on the rocks, I should not find savage Indians. Seals are never plentiful in these waters, but in Three Island Cove I saw one on the rocks and other signs of the absence of savage men. On the next day the wind was again blowing a gale, and although she was in the lee of the land, the sloop dragged her anchors, so that I had to get her under way and beat farther into the cove, where I came into a landlocked pool. At another time or place this would have been a rash thing to do, and it was safe now only from the fact that the gale which drove me to shelter would keep the Indians from crossing the strait. Seeing this was the case, I went ashore with a gun and axe on an island, where I could not in any event be surprised, and there felled trees and split about a cord of firewood, which loaded my small boat several times. While I carried the wood, though I was morally sure there were no savages near, I never once went to or from the skiff without my gun. While I had that in a clear field of over 80 yards about me, I felt safe. The spray sailed from Three Island Cove in the morning after the gale went down, but was glad to return for shelter from another sudden gale. Sailing again on the following day, she fetched Borgia Bay, a few miles on her course, where vessels had anchored from time to time and had nailed boards on the trees ashore with name and date of harboring carved or painted. Nothing else could I see to indicate that civilized man had ever been there. I had taken a survey of the gloomy place with my spyglass and was getting my boat out to land and take notes when the Chilean gunboat Huemul came in, and officers coming on board advised me to leave the place at once, a thing that required little eloquence to persuade me to do. I accepted the captain's offer of a tow to the next anchorage, at the place called Notch Cove, 8 miles farther along, where I should be clear of the worst of the Fuegians. We made anchorage at the cove about dark that night, while the wind came down in fierce willow-waws from the mountains. An instance of Magellan weather was afforded when the Huemul, a well-appointed gunboat of great power, after attempting on the following day to proceed on her voyage, was obliged by sheer force of the wind to return and take up anchorage again and remain till the gale abated, and lucky she was to get back. I was left alone the next day, for then the Huemul put out on her voyage, the gale having abated. I spent a day taking in wood and water. By the end of that time, the weather was fine. Then I sailed from the desolate place. There is little more to be said concerning the Spray's first passage through the strait that would differ from what I have already recorded. She anchored and weighed many times and beat many days against the current, with now and then a slant for a few miles, till finally she gained anchorage and shelter for the night at Port Tamar, with Cape Pilar in sight to the west. Here I felt the throb of the great ocean that lay before me. I knew now that I had put a world behind me and that I was opening out another world ahead. I had passed the haunts of savages. Great piles of granite mountains of bleak and lifeless aspect were now astern. On some of them, not even a speck of moss had ever grown. There was an unfinished newness all about the land. On the hill back of Port Tamar, a small beacon had been thrown up, showing that some man had been there. But how could one tell but that he had died of loneliness and grief? In a bleak land is not the place to enjoy solitude. Throughout the whole of the strait west of Cape Froward, I saw no animals except dogs owned by savages. Birds were not plentiful. The scream of a wild fowl, which I took for a loon, sometimes startled me with its piercing cry. The steamboat duck, so-called because it propels itself over the sea with its wings and resembles a miniature side-wheel steamer in its motion, was sometimes seen scurrying on out of danger. It never flies, but hitting the water instead of the air with its wings, it moves faster than a rowboat or a canoe. The few fur seals I saw were very shy, and of fishes I saw next to none at all. I did not catch one. Here in the strait I found great abundance of mussels of an excellent quality. I fared sumptuously on them. There was a sort of swan, smaller than a Muscovy duck, which might have been brought down with the gun. But in the loneliness of life about the dreary country, I found myself in no mood to make one life less, except in self-defense. It was the 3rd of March when the Spray sailed from Port Tamar direct for Cape Pilar, with the wind from the northeast, which I fervently hoped might hold till she cleared the land, but there was no such good luck in store. It soon began to rain and thicken in the northwest, boding no good. The Spray neared Cape Pilar rapidly and plunged in the Pacific Ocean at once, taking her first bath of it in the gathering storm. There was no turning back, even had I wished to do so, for the land was now shut out by the darkness of night. The sea was confused and treacherous. In such a time as this, the old fisherman prayed, "Remember, Lord, my ship is small and thy sea is so wide." I saw now only the gleaming crests of the waves. They showed white teeth while the sloop balanced over them. "Everything for an offing," I cried, and to this end I carried on all the sail she would bear. She ran all night with a free sheet, but on the morning of March 4th the wind shifted to southwest, then back suddenly to northwest and blew with terrific force. The Spray, stripped of her sails, then bore off under bare poles. No ship in the world could have stood up against so violent a gale. Knowing that this storm might continue for many days and that it would be impossible to work back to the westward along the coast outside of Tierra del Fuego, there seemed nothing to do but to keep on and go east about after all. Anyhow, for my present safety, the only course lay in keeping her before the wind, and so she drove southeast, as though about to round the horn, while the waves rose and fell and bellowed their never-ending story of the sea. But the hand that held these also held the Spray. She was running now with a reefed forestaysail, the sheets flat amidship. I paid out two long ropes to steady her course and to break combing seas astern, and I lashed the helm amidship. In this trim she ran before it, shipping never a sea. Even while the storm raged at its worst, my ship was wholesome and noble. My mind as to her seaworthiness was put at ease. The first day of the storm gave the Sprayer actual test in the worst sea that Cape Horn or its wild regions could afford, and in no part of the world could a rougher sea be found than at this particular point, namely off Cape Pilar, the grim sentinel of the Horn. Farther offshore, while the sea was majestic, there was less apprehension of danger. There the Spray rode, now like a bird on the crest of a wave, and now like a waif down in the hollow between seas, and so she drove on. Whole days passed, counted as other days, but with always a thrill, yes, of delight. On the fourth day of the gale, rapidly nearing the pitch of Cape Horn, I inspected my chart and pricked off the course and distance to Port Stanley in the Falkland Islands, where I might find my way and refit, when I saw through a rift in the clouds a high mountain about 7 leagues away on the port beam. The fierce edge of the gale by this time had blown off, and I'd already bent a squaresail on the boom in place of the mainsail, which was torn to rags. I hauled in the trailing ropes, hoisted this awkward sail reefed, the forestaysail already being set, and under this sail brought her at once on the wind heading for the land, which appeared as an island in the sea. So it turned out to be, though not the one I had supposed. I was exultant over the prospect of once more entering the Strait of Magellan and beating through again into the Pacific, for it was more than rough on the outside coast of Tierra del Fuego. It was indeed a mountainous sea. Under pressure of the smallest sail I could set, she made for the land like a racehorse, and steering her over the crests of the waves so that she might not trip was nice work. I stood at the helm now and made the most of it. Night closed in before the sloop reached the land, leaving her feeling the way in pitchy darkness. I saw breakers ahead before long. At this I wore ship and stood offshore, but was immediately startled by the tremendous roaring of breakers again ahead and on the lee bow. This puzzled me, for there should have been no broken water where I supposed myself to be. I kept off a good bit, then wore round, but finding broken water also there, threw her head again offshore. And this way, among dangers, I spent the rest of the night. Hail and sleet and the fierce squalls cut my flesh till the blood trickled over my face. But what of that? It was daylight, and the sloop was in the midst of the Milky Way of the sea, which is northwest of Cape Horn, and it was the white breakers of a huge sea over sunken rocks which had threatened to engulf her through the night. It was Fury Island I had sighted and steered for, and what a panorama was before me now and all around. It was not the time to complain of a broken skin. What could I do but fill away among the breakers and find a channel between them now that it was day? Since she had escaped the rocks through the night, surely she would find her way by daylight. This was the greatest sea adventure of my life. God knows how my vessel escaped. The sloop at last reached inside of small islands that sheltered her in smooth water. Then I climbed the mast to survey the wild scene astern. The great naturalist Darwin looked over this seascape from the deck of the Beagle and wrote in his journal, "Any landsman seeing the Milky Way would have nightmare for a week." He might have added, "or seaman as well." The Spray's good luck followed fast. I discovered, as she sailed along through a labyrinth of islands, that she was in the Coburn Channel, which leads into the Strait of Magellan at a point opposite Cape Froward, that she was already passing Thieves' Bay, suggestively named. And at night, March 8, behold, she was at anchor in a snug cove at the Turn. Every heartbeat on the Spray now counted thanks. Here I pondered on the events of the last few days, and strangely enough, instead of feeling rested from sitting or lying down, I now began to feel jaded and worn. But a hot meal of venison stew soon put me right, so that I could sleep. As drowsiness came on, I sprinkled the deck with tacks, and then I turned in, bearing in mind the advice of my old friend Samblich that I was not to step on them myself. I saw to it that not a few of them stood business end up, for when the Spray passed Thieves' Bay, two canoes had put out and followed in her wake, and there was no disguising the fact any longer that I was alone. Now, it is well known that one cannot step on a tack without saying something about it. A pretty good Christian will whistle when he steps on the commercial end of a carpet tack. A savage will howl and claw the air, and that was just what happened that night about 12 o'clock, while I was asleep in the cabin, where the savages thought they had me, sloop and all, but changed their minds when they stepped on deck, for then they thought that I or somebody else had them. I had no need of a dog. They howled like a pack of hounds. I had hardly use for a gun. They jumped pell-mell, some into their canoes and some into the sea, to cool off, I suppose, and there was a deal of free language over it as they went. I fired several guns when I came on deck to let the rascals know that I was home, and then I turned in again, feeling sure I should not be disturbed any more by people who left in so great a hurry. The Fuegians, being cruel, are naturally cowards. They regard a rifle with superstitious fear. The only real danger one could see that might come from their quarter would be from allowing them to surround one within bowshot, or to anchor within range where they might lie in ambush. As for the coming on deck at night, even had I not put tacks about, I could have cleared them off by shots from the cabin and hold. I always kept a quantity of ammunition within reach in the hold and in the cabin and the forepeak, so that retreating to any of these places I could hold the fort simply by shooting up through the deck. Perhaps the greatest danger to be apprehended was from the use of fire. Every canoe carries fire. Nothing is thought of that, for it is their custom to communicate by smoke signals. A harmless brand that lies smoldering in the bottom of one of their canoes might be ablaze in one's cabin if he were not on the alert. The port captain of Sandy Point warned me particularly of this danger. Only a short time before, they had fired a Chilean gunboat by throwing brands in through the stern windows of the cabin. The Spray had no openings in the cabin or deck, except two scuttles, and these were guarded by fastenings which could not be undone without waking me if I were asleep. On the morning of the 9th, after a refreshing rest and a warm breakfast, and after I had swept the deck of tacks, I got out what spare canvas there was on board and began to sew the pieces together in the shape of a peak for my square mainsail, the tarpaulin. The day, to all appearances, promised fine weather and light winds, but appearances in Tierra del Fuego do not always count. While I was wondering why no trees grew on the slope abreast of the anchorage, half-minded to lay by the sail-making and land with my gun for some game and to inspect a white boulder on the beach near the brook, a willowaw came down with such terrific force as to carry the spray, with two anchors down, like a feather out of the cove and away into deep water. No wonder trees did not grow on that side of the hill. Great, Boreas! A tree would need to be all roots to hold on against such a furious wind. From the cove to the nearest land, to leeward, was a long drift, however, and I had ample time to weigh both anchors before the sloop came near any danger, so no harm came of it. I saw no more savages that day or the next. They probably had some sign by which they knew of the coming willowaws. At least, they were wise in not being afloat even on the second day, for I had no sooner gotten to work at sail-making again, after the anchor was down, than the wind, as on the day before, picked the sloop up and flung her seaward with a vengeance, anchor and all, as before. This fierce wind swept the sloop by several miles of steep bluffs and precipices overhanging a bold shore of wild and uninviting appearance. I was not sorry to get away from it, though in doing so it was no Elysian shore to which I shaped my course. I kept on sailing in hope, since I had no choice but to go on, heading across for St. Nicholas Bay, where I had cast anchor February 19. It was now the 10th of March. Upon reaching the bay the second time, I had circumnavigated the wildest part of desolate Tierra del Fuego. It was the small island in the middle of the bay for which the sloop had been steering, and which she made with such unerring aim as to nearly run it down. Farther along in the bay was the anchorage, which I managed to reach. But before I could get the anchor down, another squall caught the sloop and whirled her around like a top and carried her away, altogether to leeward of the bay. Still farther to leeward was a great headland, and I bore off for that. This was retracing my course toward Sandy Point, for the gale was from the southwest. It was daybreak when the wind had gone down, and cat's paws took the place of willowaws. The sloop was then drifting slowly toward Sandy Point. She came within sight of ships at anchor in the roads, and I was more than half-minded to put in for new sails, but the wind coming out from the northeast, which was fair for the other direction, I turned the prow of the spray westward once more for the Pacific, to traverse a second time the second half of my first course through the strait. I was determined to rely on my own small resources to repair the damages of the great gale which drove me southward toward the Horn, after I'd passed from the Strait of Magellan out into the Pacific. So when I had got back into the strait, by way of Coburn Channel, I did not proceed eastward for help at the Sandy Point settlement, but turning again into the northwest reach of the strait, set to work with my palm and needle at every opportunity, when at anchor and when sailing. It was slow work, but little by little the squaresail on the boom expanded to the dimensions of a serviceable mainsail, with a peak to it and a leech besides. If it was not the best setting sail afloat, it was at least very strongly made and would stand a hard blow. A ship, meeting the spray long afterward, reported her as wearing a mainsail of some improved design, but this was not the case. The spray for a few days after the storm enjoyed fine weather, and made fair time through the strait for the distance of 20 miles, which in these days of many adversities I called a long run. The weather, I say, was fine for a few days, but it brought little rest. Care for the safety of my vessel, and even for my own life, was in no wise lessened by the absence of heavy weather. Indeed, the peril was even greater, inasmuch as the savages, on comparatively fine days, ventured forth on the marauding excursions, and in boisterous weather disappeared from sight, their wretched canoes being frail and undeserving the name of craft at all. This being so, I now enjoyed gales of wind as never before, and the spray was never long without them during his struggles about Cape Horn. At Snug Bay, I anchored at gray morning after passing Cape Froward, to find, when broad day appeared, that two canoes, which I had eluded by sailing all night, were now entering the same bay stealthily under the shadow of the high headland. They were well manned, and the savages were well armed with spears and bows. At a shot from my rifle across the bows, both turned aside into a small creek out of range. In danger now of being flanked by the savages in the bush close aboard, I was obliged to hoist the sails, which I'd barely lowered, and make across to the opposite side of the strait, distance of 6 miles. But now I was put to my wit's end as to how I should weigh anchor, for through an accident to the windlass right here I could not budge it. However, I set all sail and filled away, first hauling short by hand. The sloop carried her anchor away, as though it was meant to be always towed in this way, underfoot, and with it she towed a ton or more of kelp from a reef in the bay, the wind blowing a wholesale breeze. Meanwhile, I worked till blood started from my fingers, and with one eye over my shoulder for savages, I watched at the same time, and sent a bullet whistling whenever I saw a limb or a twig move, for I kept a gun always at hand, and an Indian appearing then within range would have been taken as a declaration of war. As it was, however, my own blood was all that was spilt, and from the trifling accident of sometimes breaking the flesh against a cleat or a pen which came in the way when I was in haste. Sea cuts in my hands from pulling on hard, wet ropes were sometimes painful and often bled freely, but these healed when I finally got away from the strait into fine weather.